On this episode of The Big Number, the Knicks take a 3-2 lead over the Hawks thanks to Mike Brown unlocking Karl-Anthony Towns. We stay in the East and take a look at some favorites starting to feel nervous. We round out the show by taking a look at the new reported anti-tanking measures in the draft lottery reform. All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and as always, we are joined by my man, your man, Dan Devine. What's going on, Dan?
Tom, I come to you from New York City, where a scant few days ago, all hope was lost. CJ McCollum was elbowing Zoran Mamdani out of the way as the new ruler of New York City. And now, you know, what a difference just a few days make. As the Knicks have reasserted their primacy in this matchup, heading into what's looks like a pretty interesting set of like games 5, 6s, and maybe 7s in the Eastern Conference? Question mark. More will be revealed, but yeah, pretty interesting Tuesday night in New York and Wednesday around the league.
Yeah, so you were at the game on Tuesday night when the Knicks went up 3-2. And so we're going to stay there. We're going to talk about this Knicks series and what I think is a dramatic shift in the Eastern Conference and a development that we have to cover here with today's big number. Today's big number is 26. That is the number of assists that Karl-Anthony Towns has registered in this series, which is notable because that's more than his entire postseason last year. That's right. Karl-Anthony Towns has 26 assists in 5 games, and that's more than he had in 18 games in the run-up to the Eastern Conference Finals last year. So this is a huge development, not just for the Knicks, but I think for the Eastern Conference, because now we're seeing the Celtics are scuffling against the 76ers. The Cavs are knotted up against the Toronto Raptors, and of course, we might be just hours away from the Detroit Pistons being ousted in the 1-8 matchup here against the Orlando Magic. And now we see this new Mike Brown offense, the decision to have Karl-Anthony Towns having this like Nikola Jokic-like kind of hub at the top of the key in this flex motion offense that is really throwing a wrench in the gears of the Atlanta Hawks defense. And 26 assists by Karl-Anthony Towns in 5 games. The assist, of course, is double what it was when he was with the Timberwolves a couple years ago. And just about 3 times his assist rate last postseason, with just 24 assists in 18 games. Just wasn't part of his game at all under Tom Thibodeau. And now, in the last 2 games, we've really seen this new groove for the Knicks, and Jalen Brunson went off for 39 points. It was awesome in Game 5, but I think a lot of this obscures the story that I think is really of the Eastern Conference now, is this guy, Karl-Anthony Towns, is the hub of the Knicks offense in ways that I think is going to change the Eastern Conference landscape. And so it was a great offensive game in the distribution column for Kat. And Dan, you hit on this in your column. This does have a big shift in how we look at the Knicks if this is sustainable, if this is new, and it looks like Karl-Anthony Towns is very comfortable in this position.
I mean, it makes sense because we've known he has this ability, right? The ability to be a hub at the elbows or at the top of the key and like 7-footer with good court vision and touch to pick out cutters over the top. It was interesting, you know, when the Knicks made the deal to bring Karl-Anthony Towns in from Minnesota, it wasn't just moving off of Julius Randle. They also needed to find somebody to replace Isaiah Hartenstein, since he's went and signed in Oklahoma City. And they had found so much success with Hartenstein as like an elbow hub in the dribble handoff game, having Brunson run off of him, Deuce McBride running off of him, the way that they were able to facilitate there. And so I think the mind's eye goal of what Towns could be for this Knicks offense was sort of like if you mashed Hartenstein and Randle together. He could be a high usage scorer. He could be that facilitator. He could be somebody that could stretch the floor or play out of the post and demand a double and kick out from there. And you're kind of seeing all of that in these last 2 games against the Hawks. And I think it's interesting because I think there's a way to look at Towns' performance in Game 5, especially. Game 4, it's a triple-double. That's easy to understand, right? 20, 10, and 10. We get that. In Game 5, He finishes with 16 points and he only has 7 field goal attempts. And you can look at that and say, they're just not getting enough oomph out of Karl Towns in this offense. The entire like offensive structure in the early goings of these last two games, and went throughout game four, and then as the Hawks tried to adjust to plug up the dam, leaks sprung open everywhere else and Brunson got loose. But the entire structure of it is elbow catch for Cat. You've got Brunson kind of running off of him to try to set a flex screen in the corner on OG Anunoby. OG Anunoby trying to cut into the paint. And then if the defense goes with Anunoby, Brunson's off the ball and either to pop three for a catch and shoot three or run off a catch from Towns. And Towns can just read all this out because the Hawks don't have the size to make that a problem for him. And that action of like, we're going to put these three, our three best offensive players in this setting in action together has just been brutal for the Hawks to deal with. And the Knicks are getting good stuff, whether it's a shot attempt for OG, like a cut to the paint, a good look for Brunson as he's able to get going off the ball and catch with a head of steam. Towns driving to the rim because that game is unlocked for him against smaller defenders, or a foul. Like the Knicks are in the bonus because they're attacking the paint with this stuff. Like it's just generating everything. The whole pinata bursts open out of this alignment. And now maybe that wouldn't be the case against every opponent. The Hawks, I mean, heading into this series, you looked at it and said, there just isn't a good matchup for Karl-Anthony Towns. Onyeka Okongwu is smaller. Towns should be able to get where he wants to go there. There is no backup center really because Jock Landale is out. So the Hawks started relying on Mo Gay. He picks up a hip-ish injury early in the series. They got to go to Tony Bradley. And Tony Bradley just frankly has not been up to that challenge. No one should have expected that he would be. And so Towns only takes 7 shots, but his fingerprints are all over what has been the best offensive stretch of this series for the Knicks in these last two games, and a real like reassertion of why this Knicks team could be a real threat. Because when you get 39 from Brunson, that's great. The important part there is it's 23 shots and it's less heavy lifting. A lot of it is him working off the ball rather than having to create every single step against Dyson Daniels, against Nikhil Alexander-Walker. Now, he can do that. And, you know, just watch that fourth quarter tape where he's absolutely like making Dyson Daniels his creature as they move around in court to 17 points. But it's make it easier for him so he doesn't have to do quite as much as that. Slightly fewer touches, slightly lower usage, a little bit easier to get the ball up the court, a little bit, you know, less time of possession and a little bit more opportunity for him to not have to generate everything himself, all that self-creation. This was the idea, or one of the many ideas behind the Mike Brown hire. And there's been fits and starts. Towns all season long has said, like, as you know, there's multiple times where he said he just didn't really know where he fit in the offense. He was trying to adapt and adjust. And it wasn't just him, it was everybody. Brunson had to give back a little bit. OG Anunoby had to, you know, there would be times where he wasn't going to be featured. Mikal Bridges, difficult series for him, but he had to sacrifice some on-ball touches too. Like everybody had to kind of let go a little bit to give the Knicks more options. And this is what happens. You get, you know, you plug up one hole, something else springs open. And now it feels like the dam is burst for the Hawks defense. The Knicks offense is getting basically whatever they want on whatever possession they throw, they go down. And you can see the vision here. It maybe didn't always look so clear, but you're seeing it now. And it can be pretty overwhelming when everything comes together.
Yeah, I think one of the big reasons why the Knicks moved off of Tom Thibodeau is because it just felt like Jalen Brunson creating everything for the offense wasn't sustainable long term. Was you're just going to run them down into the ground and they're going to have to get more of a diverse offense and try to get him freed up a little bit easier. So he's just not pounding the rock for, you know, 48 minutes a game, which you saw a lot of that with the lineup that they had last year and the last few years. And we were kind of worrying, Dan, that what is Mike Brown really changing much with this offense? And here we have in the last two games, very much so, that when you're seeing it in that game, the other in game four with the triple double, but also in this last game, he had 4 assists. Karl-Anthony Towns had 4 assists to Jalen Brunson alone. That is as many as he had in the entire postseason last year to Jalen Brunson.
Wow.
In that one game on Tuesday night, he had as many assists as he had to Jalen Brunson in the entire postseason last year. So if you want to point to something that as a Knicks fan, you can hope, all right, we made a change off of Tom Thibodeau. And while it felt like this season was a slog and maybe we didn't get as much as we wanted to see that there was a difference between these two coaches and Mike Brown was the right hire, what you're seeing is a definitely a different mix in terms of the offensive responsibilities of Karl Anthony Towns as that guy who you saw it so many times on the elbow or at the top of the key where he's palming the ball, holding it out like MJ, and kind of giving these little scoop passes and backdoor cuts like Nikola Jokic, which was really interesting to see from Karl Anthony Towns. And, you know, in this series alone, you saw 7 assists to Jalen Brunson from Karl Anthony Towns. And last year, there was only 4. You noted to me that OG Anunoby, he's already outpaced last year's assist total to OG Anunoby in this series alone. So what we're seeing from Karl Anthony Towns is taking more of that playmaking responsibility. And I think this is an important thing, that Jalen Brunson is scoring so much more at the basket. In game 5 alone, he had 8 baskets at the rim, and a lot of those were off of those feeds, off of those cuts. Makes a whole lot easier on Jalen Brunson. I would imagine if you looked at his heart rate when he's dribbling against Dyson Daniels 23 times in an offensive set and not getting anywhere. There was a play midway through the second quarter where he literally dribbled 23 times trying to get past Dyson Daniels, and he just gave it up to Karl Anthony Towns. And then they ran an action where it was like a fake handoff, and then he screened, he stuck his ass out and made sure that Dyson Daniels was going to get screened. And then he hit a little like cut, a backdoor cut, little pass there to Jalen Brunson for an easy layup, just nobody guarding him. And it was kind of this like eureka moment for me, is like, if they can get that action where Jalen Brunson doesn't have to dribble 23 times going into Dyson Daniels, or if it's Derek White, or if it's insert on-ball defender here that is going to be so draining, you could just get the ball to Karl Anthony Towns, run some off-court actions, and you're going to see a lot better Jalen Brunson, more efficient Jalen Brunson, 15 to 23 in this game, with 8 of those baskets coming at the rim, which is a career high for Jalen Brunson in the playoffs. We've never seen him score more buckets at the rim. And a lot of that is because Karl Anthony Towns is not only in the half court being the hub, but Dan, also we saw, hey, in transition, I'm going to kick out ahead to Jalen Brunson so he can literally outrun Dyson Daniels and Nikhil Alexander-Walker and getting an open layup at the rim rather than having to just have this marathon of trying to dribble the air out of the ball, trying to get some daylight. They're getting daylight in so many easier actions than what we saw last year. And the game 4 and 5, it felt like a sea change for the Knicks going forward.
And that goes back to maybe where there's the quieter impact of Towns that doesn't show up in the shot attempts. Like, why can the Knicks run? He is controlling the defensive glass. Him and OG Anunoby, I think Brown shouted them out last night, 22 defensive rebounds between the two of them. And the Hawks, I think, only had 28 rebounds or 27 rebounds as a team total. With cutting off the offensive rebounding for Atlanta, then kickstarting their transition game. And then also, like, when you're being a high efficiency offense on your when you have the ball, you're limiting the opportunity for them to grab the ball off the rim and push, which this, you know, transition has been the lifeblood of this Hawks offense ever since they kind of rejiggered the flow without Trae Young. And like, that's their. Because, or in part because of the impact Towns is having in that real estate in front of the rim. And the other part of it, you know, you mentioned the difficulty of getting around Dyson Daniels, creating space. He's been a sensational on-ball defender and off-ball defender as well in this series. Like he is just everywhere you know that Brunson wants to be, he's in his face. And so Mike Brown has talked about the importance of moving Brunson around as much as possible. But one big reason why Brunson got going a little earlier in game five, was because of the way Towns was busting up the Hawks coverage, they had to go to the cross match. Quinn Snyder flipped that switch and said, we're going to put Daniels on Towns, and we're going to put Onyeka Okongwu on OG Anunoby, and we're going to shuffle the board a little bit. We're going to have Nikhil Alexander-Walker deal with Brunson. And so you take your best on-ball defender off of the Knicks' best on-ball scorer because you have to plug the hole with Towns. And so, and you know, Nikhil Alexander-Walker is a super capable on-ball defender as well, Brunson didn't like, you know, go off for 30 points in the first quarter or anything like that. And then the matchups did, you know, revert and go back because the Hawks were just continuing to search for what they could find to slow down this Knicks offense any way they could. But it's, again, like the impact and the influence of what Towns provides, the versatility and variety of what he opens up for you in the playbook on the offensive end. You're seeing all of the impacts of that, the downstream effects of that. And oh, by the way, this is the best defensive play that I've seen from Karl-Anthony Towns in a postseason series. I mean, there was a series where he was, sort of the first line of defense on Nikola Jokic a few years ago. He acquitted himself really well in the postseason last year, sort of quietly. But he's, because he's also often cross-matched off of Daniels, because there's just so many, or off of Jonathan Kuminga, because the Hawks have multiple non-shooters, he's allowed to park himself at the rim more. And he's got great hands, active hands up, you know, blocking shots at the rim, swiping in for steals. He's been really good with his footwork up at the level of the screen, like aggressive pick and roll coverage. So you're seeing the best version of Towns kind of across the board here. And he doesn't have to take more than 10 shots a game to provide it. And so I think that's the exciting thing from if you have some vested interest in what the Knicks sort of the top flight version of the Knicks is, the firing on all cylinders version of the Knicks is, it's that they can beat you with the Brunson ball. They can find another way to get at the offense through operating through Towns and having all these off-ball cuts and all this space created in the middle. They can crank up the defense to a level that they maybe haven't reached in years past. Like Josh Hart basically enveloped CJ McCollum midway through this series. CJ McCollum 6 points on 3-for-10 shooting with 4 turnovers in game five. He basically wasn't heard from. That's without OG Anunoby and what Nickeil Alexander-Walker is having to deal with Mikal Bridges off the ball. Like, there are just a lot of ways to win. And whether this one with Towns operating from the elbow and throwing the hook passes over the top is going to work against everybody, I don't know. But the thing with Mike Brown's sort of structure here and the way the Knicks have developed things, they maybe have more than one card to play, which I don't know if that was always the case in years past.
It's a great way to put it, is that there's just more levers that Mike Brown is willing to pull here rather than Thibodeau, who in years past, it's just the rigidity that we kept hearing about in the offseason, the rigidity that he has a narrow-minded of what a view of what works in the NBA, and it has veiled him so many times in the regular season and in the postseason, the runs that the Knicks have had. You just wish that there were other cards that he could pull and play in the playoff atmosphere. And look, there's a level of skepticism that this can be sustainable against other defenses, that maybe the Atlanta Hawks' lack of size. And this is something I noticed a lot watching Towns in this hub action, is that he's just so much bigger than Onyeka Okongwu. And that size difference, you can see above the defense, hold the ball out, and get a lot of, you know, daylight and space to operate as the hub in ways that against Kata, against, I don't know what's going to happen with this Magic Pistons series, but against size, where a guy is able to match against Jokic or against Rudy Gobert, is he able to be this kind of hub in ways that he's able to see over a Kongwu in this series? And they just don't have that size advantage against every single team. But against the Hawks, this is certainly a way to get the most out of Karl-Anthony Towns. In some ways, like the size advantage, you want him to bully guys in the paint. But Mike Brown is saying we can use that size advantage to have him operate as a Jokic or as a Şengün, a guy who can use that hub, the LeBron in the post, and try to feed guys off the cuts. And I think it's a big reason why you're seeing Jalen Brunson be this efficient. OG Anunoby shooting the heck out of the ball in this series, 54% from downtown, 57% from the floor. Big reason why is he's getting efficient looks from Karl-Anthony Towns and all the gravity from Jalen Brunson and Kat. So how are they unlocking this offense in ways that they didn't do under Tom Thibodeau? It's because they're using Karl-Anthony Towns for all of his gifts and his passing ability. So this is, I wasn't feeling great about the Knicks coming out of the East a couple weeks ago. I feel a whole lot better now after we're seeing this different dimension to this team. And Mike Brown is certainly at the controls there. and doing a great job and bouncing back from a lot of criticism there in the first few games of the series. So, Dan, we're going to talk about the rest of the Eastern Conference here after the break here, because the Knicks having this momentum and this shift in the way that they're using their offense and Karl-Anthony Towns has got to have a lot of the rest of the teams in the East thinking a little bit more. And Boston, Detroit, and the Cavs are certainly having some issues here. We'll get into that. And also, we're going to talk the draft reform that has leaked out. Shams Charania and Sam Amick are reporting that the NBA is doing a proposal to redo the entire draft lottery. We're going to talk about that later in the show. But first, we'll catch this break and talk about the rest of the East. All right, Dan, this week's big number, 26, the number of assists that Karl-Anthony Towns has in this five-game series so far, which is more than he had in the entire 18-game playoff run last year. So Karl-Anthony Towns, new groove for Kat, and it's coming at a great time because the rest of the East is scuffling here. So let's talk about that with your three little numbers. What's your first little number looking at the rest of the East?
First little number, we're going to start with still the favorites in the East, but a little shaky after Tuesday night. First little number is 14, which is how many consecutive field goals the Boston Celtics missed to end Game 5 of their first-round series against the Philadelphia 76ers. Boston's final field goal on Tuesday night was an Amias Keita alley-oop from Jaylen Brown with 7 minutes and 3 seconds left in the fourth quarter, 7:03. From that point on, the Sixers outscored the Celtics 16-3, completely flipping a game where Boston had led by 13 points in the third quarter. 3-for-22 from the field for Boston in the fourth quarter, which works out to 13.6%, which, let's round it up to 14, just to make it a little bit harmonious with our little number here. Boston's offense going into the deep freeze late is something we have seen before. 52.4 offensive rating in the fourth quarter for the Celtics, which is pretty bad. Allowed the Sixers to pull off the upset and come all the way back, win going away 113-97, forcing a game 6 back in Philly on Thursday night. If going 0-for-14 to end a playoff game sounds uniquely bad, that is because it is. According to our pal Tim Bontemps of ESPN, that is the longest 0-for to end a playoff game since 2005, which is quite a long time ago. After the game, Celtics coach Joe Mazzulla obviously freaked out and said a whole lot about it. Nope, 6 seconds of stoicism, classic Joe. Just missed some shots. Thought we had some good looks, but didn't capitalize on them. Just said we didn't execute, and they have to be able to bounce back from that. We will do the same things we always do, which, again, sounds about right. We've seen the script before from Boston in the postseason, Tom. You know, the jumper stop going down, the big lead fritters away, and all of a sudden, the winning machine starts to grind down. This happened twice against the Knicks last May when they blew 20-point leads at home, and all of a sudden, they were looking up at the lights in the Eastern Conference semifinals. So what do you think here? Is this cause for real concern for the Celtics, or are we looking at, again, a blip on the radar, shot variance, and all will revert to form in Game 6 in Philly?
The 76ers just ran them off the line. I think that's the big story here, is that the Sixers were able to assert their dominance and actually take away the Celtics' strength in ways that clearly the Celtics were uncomfortable in that fourth quarter. And also, like, this is, you know, growing up in New England, a lot of Celtics fans are getting a lot of anxiety about the three-point volume and if they don't shoot well from downtown, what that looks like. But I think what's interesting is that the Sixers took away so many of the threes, and then and Joel Embiid talked about this after the game, is that they cut out a lot. They ran them off the three-point line, and then the Celtics just look lost. This is the first time since February 27th, 2024, that the Celtics had fewer three-point attempts than the Sixers in a game. 12 straight wow. games in which they had more three-point attempts than the Sixers, and then in this game, the Sixers got him up from downtown, and something they wanted to do more of. But also they were able to take the Celtics away from that game, and they just don't like to do this. They don't like to operate in the around the basket, inside the arc. It's not their game. They like to drive and kick for open threes, and it's kind of their MO. And in the postseason, we've seen this where the offense just kind of bogs down and doesn't really get, look like they are very comfortable figuring out how to create offense when they're not able to drive and kick and get those open threes. And Joel Embiid in the fourth quarter took over. But I noticed that in his post-game press conference and his conversations and his interviews, it was a lot about the defense. And we know studies show that the defense can control opponent three-point volume and the number of attempts you get way more than the actual field goal percentage on those three-point attempts. And I thought Nick Nurse did an excellent job running off the Celtics from that three-point line. And it looked like this team could not figure out how to generate good offense after that. In the fourth quarter, just abominable offense there with 39 three-point attempts for the Celtics in that game and 42 for the 76ers. It's almost like they gave a taste of their own medicine there for the Boston Celtics. And it's like, hey, if we can run you off that three-point line, you're not going to know what to do. And that's the Joe Mazzulla offense is like, hey, we're going to get a lot more three-point attempts and use that margin that and lever your three-point defense to a certain extent that you're going to break eventually. But this defense, the 76ers, might have found something there in that game on Tuesday night.
And just, you know, while we are here, shout out to Joel Embiid, you know, several weeks removed from an emergency appendectomy in a have-to-have-it closeout game on the road in Boston, which has been a house of horrors for him over the course of his career. 12 for 18 inside the arc, 8 assists, just absolutely cooking and roasting whichever big man he's got to deal with. Like, Nick Vucevic is not going to be able to handle him. Nimikata, you know, not, you know, a little bit too light to be able to handle the drives and the bullying. And like, when he's got that mid-range, like stepping into those foul line pull-ups, like it's absolutely cash. And the everything changes. Like, we can't rely on the Sixers. You know, you can't depend on them. You can't necessarily project them in any reasonable certainty because of Embiid's myriad injuries and lack of availability. But when he is there and when he is right and when he is cooking, they are as dangerous as it gets, which is why this is still has the potential to be a pretty dangerous close here for the Celtics. Also, Derek White, the shot, the three-point shot, it's been gone for most of the year.
Dan, it's not like Amen Thompson territory or Tony Allen territory, but we're approaching that Derek White is going to be that kind of guy where defenses are just going to say, go ahead, shoot it. Because it's, I don't know if it's the yips or if there's something mechanically he's doing differently, but the way that he is missing those threes, those open threes for the last 6+ months, I think it's going to become a problem for the Celtics in ways that maybe we can't just chalk this up to small sample size anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to say it's just variance, and then another thing to say, we have seen this sort of exact thing happen a number of times with the Celtics in these set of, and like, it's not particularly sexy analysis and, you know, nitty gritty stuff, but in the three wins over Philly, Boston shooting 42% from three, in the two losses, 27% from three. That is the pattern that has followed them throughout the last several years in the playoffs. When they win, it's around 40 or higher. When they lose, it's around 30 or lower. When you build the whole plane out of that, you know, those shots, if you don't make them, you know, you can find yourself in some deep trouble. Speaking of deep trouble, our second little number this week, 68.8. That was Jalen Duren's true shooting percentage during the regular season. That led the NBA. That was a top 25 mark of all time among guys who played at least 1,500 minutes in a series. And that is the past. Through 5 games against the Orlando Magic, Jalen Duren's true shooting percentage is 51.7%. Pretty disastrous drop-off, more than 17%. That's the difference between being one of the, if not the, most efficient scorer in the NBA and one of its least efficient. I could be rude and start throwing out some names, but there's no reason to any stray shots at folks who are on the low end of that spectrum here. We're going to try to stay positive this spring. During the regular season, Jalen Duren was finishing about 6 plays per game as either the roll man in the pick and roll or on cuts to the basket, you know, lurking out of the dunker spot, you know, knifing in opposite a Cade Cunningham drive, things like that. And he was scoring about 8 points per game on those plays, according to Synergy. Strong efficiency, strong volume, big man stuff. And against Orlando, they have basically cut that in half. 3 such possessions as a roll man or a cutter, 3.5 total points per game. The Magic are just like eliminating his bread and butter, and he does not have an off-speed pitch right now. No plan B. Orlando making Jalen Duren disappear has proven disastrous for the Pistons' offense. 100.5 per 100 non-garbage time possessions. That's like worst in the NBA caliber offensive efficiency, would be below even the worst teams in the NBA all season. And it's made these Pistons comically reliable, like over-reliant on Cade doing everything and Tobias Harris doing anything. And that's why they are down 3-1, fighting for their lives here, trying to avoid becoming just the seventh number one seed, to avoid falling to a number eight since the league expanded to a 16-game playoff in 1984. Tom, we talked about this on the show late in the season, you know, Duren made, like, bolstering his All-NBA case with what he did when Cade was out. Cade had the collapsed lung, and they were running things through Jalen Duren, and he was balling out. Where did that go? What happened?
Jamal Cain's dunk on him.
Oh, dude. My God.
Like, that was the icing on the cake, where I'm watching this series and being like, what happened to Jalen Duren? And then Jamal Cain just completely embarrassed him and sunned him in a way that I haven't seen. Like, the open court dunk where he came out of nowhere, and then Duren tried to contest it and got put on his ass. That's the second time I said that word on this show. I'm sorry. But the fact that he did that to Jalen Duren, who's just about the... Look at this.
Oh.
Put him on, like, sent him into the front row. He's like the strongest guy in the league, that now that Steven Adams is sidelined, and he just thrown him around like a rag doll. And on top of that, you got his ex-girlfriend out here posting about it on social media. And it's just like, yo, I feel so bad for this dude that I put on my second team All-NBA ballot. Like, man, extraordinary circumstances that we saw with this Luka Doncic and Cade Cunningham thing. If you did the All-NBA ballots now, let's just say, Jalen Duren, okay, I don't think is getting on All-NBA at all. And I think that's how poorly he's been played. His effective field goal percentage in this series is about 47%. His shot quality number from PBPStats.com has him at an expected effective field goal percentage at 57%. So the shot, he's missing these shots, these high quality shots, one of the best shot quality shot. Like, he's obviously living around the basket area, Jalen Duren. And so it's not a matter of that he's trying new stuff in the mid-range or getting low-quality shots. He's just being bullied in a way. I am shocked in this series with Wendell Carter Jr. and Paolo Banchero that he looks just tiny against Jamal Cain. It reminded me of Mike Tyson punch-out where, what's his name, where you get hit in the stomach and then you bounce backwards and then you fall to the mat. That's what he looked like in this Jamal Cain thing. Jamal Cain's not Paolo Banchero. He's not Wendell What's that?
It's King Hippo, by the way. Sorry, everybody.
King Hippo. Just that's what it is.
I forget most of what I learned in school, but I'll never forget that. That's kind of the way my brain works.
That is why you are the top assist guy in the biz. So thank you, Dan, for giving me that. I thought it's the one, the pop belly guy with the little band-aid around his belly button, right? That's what
exactly
we're talking.
Right. That's exactly right. Yep.
That's what Jalen Duren looked like, is King Hippo. So that's not a good sign if you're Jalen Duren. And it's also not a good sign that they've been able to punk him in this series. And I think if there's one, Cade Cunningham's turnovers, for sure, a big deal. But Jalen Duren being reduced to a role player again, like he was last year, all of this most improved candidacy that we saw this season, I think there's a strong argument that he is the most declined player from regular season to postseason. Oof. In this series, and a big reason why you're seeing him down 3-1.
Yeah, and a lot of that, again, is just like, if we can hit your fastball, then you got to show me a second pitch. And what Wendell Carter Jr., the rest of the Magic, in terms of the way they're shrinking the floor, the way they're going under on the pick and roll and like trying to take away his rolls to the rim, it's just like, if we cut out your cleanest, easiest, most comfortable pathway to catches and touches, his touches are down about like 4 or 5 a game in the playoffs so far, and we kind of like make you a bystander, and then you're not going to stretch, you're not going to space, so then we're clogging the paint even more. We're going, we're tightening and constricting that shell, and you can't break through it, even though you're built like Super Macho Man, another Punch Out reference, and you're not going to stretch in space, and you're out there with Asar Thompson, or you're out there, you know, like we as the Magic don't have as many guys we got to worry about. And so, yeah, then it's Cade Cunningham. You can't average 7 turnovers a game, but also a lot of these are, where is he throwing the ball? You know, where is, when he's driving into traffic, when he's trying to create in that phone booth. And Orlando, a team that we expected to be a significantly better defensive team than they were throughout the bulk of the season, they're playing at that level. You need something else. And right now, the only something else dependably that the Pistons have been able to point to is like Tobias Harris a little. And with all due respect, like that's just not enough. Like they need Jalen Duren averaged, I think, 19.5 points per game during the regular season. He's down under 10 in this series. And not for nothing, like there's your series right there. And if things don't change, which they very well might, you know, the Detroit's going to be able to fight for its life again on Wednesday. Franz Wagner, I believe, out of that game after suffering the calf strain in game four. So, you know, there's an opportunity here, certainly. But in order to get to that level, Pistons are going to have to find a way to get Jalen Duren loose. And Jalen Duren is going to have to find a way to get himself going, which he has not been able to do as yet. Speaking of some big man struggles in the Eastern Conference, our third and final little number, -15.7. That is the net rating of the Cleveland Cavaliers in the minutes where Evan Mobley has played the five without Jarrett Allen in the series against the Toronto Raptors, -15.7. So again, small samples, yada, yada, yada. We all get it at this time of year. Cavs have played 80 minutes of Mobley at the five in this series, according to PBP stats, and they have been outscored by 19 points in them. Ooh. Their offensive rating in those minutes, 106, worst in the league level offense. Their defensive rating with the defensive player of the year, pre-Wemby era at the five, 121.6, which is basically the Kings, which is not where you want to be. Cleveland has won its double big minutes. It's won the Allen no Mobley minutes, but it's played Mobley at the five more than anything else, and it has gotten blitzed in those minutes by a Raptors team that does not feel particularly overwhelming. They're throwing out Jakob Poeltl and Mamu a little bit, and a lot of small ball Colin Murray-Boyles, who I believe I had on my all-rookie first team, which is like the only thing that I remember that I did in my voting, and I think it came out pretty okay. But like, this feels like a similar situation to what we have felt in the last few years in these postseason series, where you're like, Evan Mobley has every tool in the tool bag. He can do everything that you need him to do. Maybe not shoot threes as much, but like hyper modern, hyper versatile, hyper switchable, hyper everything big. And then you get into the playoffs and it's like, hey, like 16 points and 8 rebounds. And like, he's playing fine, but they're not, you don't feel him in the same way. Is that an oversimplification of what we are seeing in this matchup with the Raptors and the Cavs? And obviously, there's plenty of blame to go around for the way the Cavs looked in Toronto and why this is a 2-2 series. But it does feel like they, at this point, they kind of want this to be a look they lean on, and it has not been a successful look for them in this matchup.
I just think that Evan Mobley is not that guy. I feel like when you look at his numbers, it plateaued over the last few years. He won Defensive Player of the Year last year, but there's no evidence that he's that kind of impact defender anymore. I thought that was an overrated campaign for him to get that award last year. And certainly in this series, he's not feeling that kind of force that you would need to have him establish as your go-to quote-unquote small ball five, where you're moving Jared Allen, who has not played up to his abilities in this postseason, and lean on Evan Mobley at the five. He's not that guy. Like, I don't see Evan Mobley. Over the last couple years, we've said, hey, the Cavs have had too many injuries. Like, we have to evaluate this team when they're healthy and when they have available. And now they got James Harden, who's bigger, a playoff-tested guy rather than Darius Garland. And here they are getting bullied by the Toronto Raptors. At some point, we have to look at this Cavs roster and just say, this isn't it. And Evan Mobley, for all the promise and the ability to play two ends of the floor, I just think at some point, this bill is going to come due, and they're looking at their salary cap and look at all the tax that they're going to have to pay on this contract and try to figure out how to make a move to entice someone to take Evan Mobley, or, and this is too early to say this, but like the whole Giannis thing, it's really interesting if they get ousted in this first round. And once again, the Evan Mobley, Jared Allen lineup does not work, and they need to get something stronger, more force, and have a guy who, yes, on the wrong side of 30, but man, a lot more pressure on the defense and the opposing offense than what Evan Mobley and Jared Allen are doing. So I'm with you. I feel like it's been really disappointing, the Evan Mobley experience this season, and especially against the Toronto Raptors. I just feel like he's just another guy out there and not the franchise pillar they need him to be.
And again, in fairness to him, I guess maybe this is less in fairness to him than in unfairness to everyone else. Like Harden, you know, did not acquit himself in any kind of great glory in Toronto. Donovan Mitchell has had some real sort of head scratching moments and some struggles offensively. You know, you were talking about Jared Allen. You know, again, I don't want to keep leaning on this, but there's that it was the moment in that series against the Knicks a few years ago where Mitchell Robinson just says like, they, you know, they get into the paint and they see me, and he sort of just like leaned back and started shivering and was like, they don't want it like this. And that's, I have such a hard time shaking that, because it like, why can't Jared Allen like post up RJ Barrett, right? Why can't Jared Allen, it's not that he has been a creature solely subsisting on James Harden pocket passes throughout his career. Like he made an all-star game and averaged like 18 points a game a couple of years ago. Like there's stuff in there. It just very rarely seems to get unlocked and come out in April and May. And yeah, at a certain point, you know, they made the decision to go off of Darius Garland. They've made the decision to go sort of hyper all in on this construction on the most expensive roster in the league. And at a certain point, I think you're right to say the bill's going to come due. Now they have, again, the opportunity. They're going back home tied 2-2. They've got home court advantage in the series. They have the opportunity to render this discussion moot if Mobley has a monster couple of games and heads them into the second round. And then, as you mentioned, with everything else in flux in the East, who knows, the pathway could still unfold for them. You just, it feels a little bit like you are expecting an Evan Mobley performance that has perhaps not been evidenced in recent postseasons, and certainly not the last couple of games in Toronto. And I feel like I'm going to need to see it to believe it. If that makes me a hater, I apologize, but I do feel like I hold open the possibility that it could happen. Just feels like you'd like to see it happen more often than this.
Yes. Yes. Well put. And I think Evan Mobley and it's not just him, like you said, but this Cavs team, if they get beat by the Toronto Raptors, it's over. Like they're going to press that blow it up button. They can't do this another year. And now they get James Harden, and like, do you bring him back? It's just, there's a lot on the line here for the Cavs against this Toronto Raptors team. And it's not giving me a lot of faith. They crumbled after that Miami Heat series last year and they swept them. I have nothing in this series that has been inspiring in the least bit. So shout out to Scotty Barnes and Jamal Shedd and the rest of the Toronto Raptors. But man, this story about the Cavs, huge implications around the league. So.
You're right. Just very, very, very quickly, you are right to make a point of saying shout out to members of the Toronto Raptors. I didn't mean to present that as if like the only relevant factor here is that the Cavs can't get it done. They're playing against a team that is doing stuff to them and that is working their ass off to, now I've said the A word in this podcast, and they're working overtime here to make life difficult on the Cavs and to physically put them in uncomfortable positions with their defense, which was their calling card all year long. So yes, Darko Rajakovic, Scotty Barnes, Jamal Shedd, Kyle Murray Boyles, they're doing the work on that end of the floor. RJ Barrett, Brandon Ingram, join us whenever you'd like. But there are guys on Toronto that are doing what they need to do to make this happen. The Cavs just need to be able to do more than that. So yes, sorry. Shouts out to the Raptors.
Yeah. Yeah. It is crazy when you think about how, you know, they acquired James Harden. It looked like that they had figured something out there in the backcourt and they're healthy. I mean, I don't know if you want to say Darius Garland's healthy. He's playing. Donovan Mitchell, excuse me. It's one thing to say that like they're available, but it's clearly that they're not 100% or close to it. So this is the playoffs. It's been a really exciting first round of the playoffs. And so we'll see what happens here on Wednesday night. Certainly things can change in a big way by the next time we do this show next week, but we got some news here on Tuesday that the NBA has a draft lottery reform proposal, another trial balloon being sent out to the media and to the public to say, hey, what do you guys think? Well, we're going to give our thoughts here coming up after the break. All right, Dan, everyone's favorite topic, draft lottery reform, tanking, ping pong balls, a relegation zone. Yeah, let's get into it here. Shams Charania reporting yesterday some details on the NBA's proposal that they sent to the 30 GMs. That is kind of written in pencil, not ink, that they still have some time here to iron out the details here. But the big story here is that the NBA is in this proposal disincentivizing teams to lose as many games as possible. There's the worst three teams in the NBA are going to have less chances than teams 4 through 10 in the draft lottery standings at winning the number one overall pick. If you have three of the worst records, you're actually going to have not as much chance to get that number one overall pick. It's a complete reversal over the current system in which teams have the best odds at getting the number one overall pick. And also in here, we're seeing an expansion from 14 teams to 16 teams, which is really interesting to me. I think it's a mistake because what you're having in this system is that the loser of the 7-8 game in the play-in tournament will have an opportunity to win the number one overall pick, and not just have an opportunity, a really good chance at getting the number one overall pick at 2.7%. So it's as if, like, in this current form, it would be getting like the number 10 spot. If you lose the 7-8 game and you still make the playoffs, you get that 8 seed, let's say it's the Orlando Magic or the Phoenix Suns, they get the 8 seed and they still have about a 3% chance of winning the number one overall pick and jumping really high into the draft. I think the other details that Dan, I don't know if you caught this, but there's also a provision that says you can't get number one 2 years in a row. You also can't be top five 3 years in a row. So what that means is that the San Antonio Spurs with Victor Wembanyama and Stephon Castle would not be allowed to have Dylan Harper in the third year of that trio. The Pistons, because they had Cade Cunningham at number one, and then Jaden Ivey there, they also would not be able to have Asar Thompson or Ron Holland, because that would be 3 and 4 in consecutive years with the top five picks. Cavs, they would not be allowed to get Evan Mobley because they had Darius Garland and Isaac Okoro, top five picks. We also can go back to the Rockets. We can go back to the Al Horford Atlanta Hawks. They would not be able to draft Al Horford because Marvin Williams and Sheldon Williams were top five picks in consecutive years, and Al Horford was the third in that trio. Of course, everyone remembers the Oklahoma City Thunder with Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and they would not be allowed to draft James Harden for the third year being a top five pick in a row. So there's big implications on that end. But I will say, I think this is definitely, Dan, an anti-tanking measure. They are going to get rid of a bulk of the tanking to the bottom, the race to the bottom. But I am cautioning people that there is going to be a lot of unintended consequences here. When we're talking about anti-tanking is one thing, but what about anti-competitive balance? Because now with the flattened odds, essentially, Dan, you're going to see a lot of teams either in the playoffs, we could see conference finalists or champions win the number one overall pick, because if you're a 7-8 seed in that play-in tournament, you have an opportunity to get the number one pick if you lose that 7-8 game and fall into the 8th slot. So you're seeing the Orlando Magic right now have the ability to move into the conference semifinals with a win over the Pistons. They could win the AJ DeBonta sweepstakes or Cam Boozer sweepstakes in this new proposed lottery. Now, it won't go in effect until 2027 under the proposal, not this year, but just as a thought experiment, I wanted to ask you, Dan, like real quick, when you saw this come across the wire, what were your thoughts about this proposal? You know, it's a lot of, you know, economics and trade-offs here, but Dan, what were your thoughts initially when you saw this?
Okay. First thought was, come on, dude, I'm trying to be in the pregame pressers for the coaches and I got to like cover a game in a little while. Like can we chill on this for a minute so that I can focus on the playoff game that's happening? And I made a snarky little joke about that showing on the screen right now, about which I got a little slap on the wrist from the league office for saying, I think you meant, you know, this bold reform that we're engaging. I promise I'll get caught up on this bold reform, which, yeah, fair enough. It's all nice to know that the NBA is reading the tweets. Also, you know, read the articles, get the traffic. So that was my first thought. My second thought was, okay, if we are trying to disincentivize the most naked forms of, like, the most unabashed, let's be as bad as possible because that gets us as good a pick as possible, I think everyone can agree, like, that's what you want to have happen here, right? Like, you don't want teams in February to start sitting out stars with fake injuries and then down the stretch and, like, yanking them from fourth quarters of games and, you know, engaging in like real torturous management to get to, you know, stumble across the finish line in a situation where you are losing as much as possible on purpose. I think if that is like the number one thing that we're trying to achieve here, I understand it. Whether this is the best way to achieve it, some people a hell of a lot smarter than this English major will have to be the ones that weigh in on that. But the thing that I, and again, maybe not the best big picture thinker on these issues, it seems to me that if you are unable to, if you get worse odds of getting the top pick when you're one of the three worst teams, and you're not able to get multiple top five picks in, you know, three and 4 years or whatever, like, what if you are just an honestly bad team? What if you are, I don't know, the Sacramento Kings or something like that, right? And you are trying to win, you are just doing it in ways that are not successful. And this would seem to be to make it a lot harder for you to be able to land the high value talent that you need to be able to do it. It doesn't necessarily remove the incentive to lose. Like, we're still, by adding more teams into the lottery mix, you're still creating an incentive where it's like, and a flatter odds means everybody's got a higher chance. Like, being bad still helps you. Being worse in certain situations does still help you, just not the absolute most naked version of it. And then if you're like in that dead zone, not the relegation zone, but in the dead zone of like fourth and fifth, you know, that it feels like you could live there for a while. You know, or if you come by being third worst, or honestly, you could be in that situation for a while. I don't know. Again, I might be missing the forest for the trees on this.
They're saying that if you're in the bottom three, there's a ceiling on how far you can fall at number 12. They're capping it. So like if you're, okay, let's say the Washington Wizards this season, and again, this won't be in effect this year. This would be in 2027. But just thought experiment. If you're the Washington Wizards this year, the furthest you could fall in this system is number 12. So, but still, if you're the Wizards or you're the Nets or you're the Jazz and you fall to 12, it's a disaster.
Disaster. Yeah.
you just wasted away the entire season so that you could have the back end of the lottery. And I understand some people look at this and say, so run your organization better and not be one of the three worst teams. I could see the Donald Glover meme right now of good. Oh, so you're a terrible team and you're not having an easy way, a little like parachute in, thing fall into your lap that you get Cam Boozer and AJ DeBonsa out of the sky. Well, good. You have to figure out a way to not be bad. That's the whole idea. But here's three things I want to say. My three biggest problems with this and the unintended consequences of this draft lottery reform idea. Number one is, if you are sick of the allegations that the NBA is rigged, you're going to get so much more of that now. We're going to hear it all the time because you're going to see the Cooper flag moving up from on the Dallas pick. That's going to be child's play compared to the next 3 years of this, because you're going to see a lot of teams that are at 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 in the draft lottery and moving up all the way to number one. So if you're sick of hearing how on draft lottery, the frozen envelope theory of Patrick Ewing going to the Knicks or LeBron, the Cavs winning the LeBron draft, the kid from Akron stays with the Cavs. And then, of course, the Cooper Flagg one where people are saying that Cooper Flagg went to the Dallas Mavericks as a repayment for them trading Luka to the Lakers. I don't know. But if you're sick and tired of the draft is rigged conversation, you're going to get at fever pitch now because of this flattened odds. Number two, I think this cannibalizes the play-in tournament. Adam Silver, one of his greatest things is that he's added the play-in tournament to have this excitement for the 7-10 seeds. But now you're introducing an incentive to lose those games and increase your odds at getting the number one overall pick. Where now, if we're watching the 7-8 game, we are going to be wondering, actively wondering, if this team is trying to win that 7-8 game, because the loser of which has a pretty good chance, in terms of historically speaking, a better chance than when the Dallas Mavericks got Cooper Flagg or the Atlanta Hawks got Zachary Risacher. The loser of the 7-8 game is going to have multiple better opportunity at getting the number one overall pick in this new structure. So I think the play-in tournament is now going to be obscured by this. Are they trying to win this game? And number three, I wrote about this, the stratified NBA, how there's an A league and a B league. The top 20 teams in the NBA had so much more distance from the bottom 10 teams in the NBA because of this draft lottery system. I think this reform is going to only create an even more stratified league of the top 12 teams, the top six in each conference. And then because every team in the play-in tournament has got a really solid chance of being in the lottery and giving themselves a good chance at number one or a top five pick, you're going to see teams tank early and try to get into that, you know, seven through the end of that draft lottery. Mm. So I think you're going to see the top six teams in each conference way higher than the rest of the league. And I think you're going to see the A league versus the B league again, but just 12 teams instead of 20. And in service. Yeah, Dan, go ahead.
No. I think that's interesting, because you're right that, you know, this is always like water is like water finds its way through every crack in the pavement, right? Like front offices will see whatever potential leverage point or incentive point that they can find here. Like, how do we maximize these new rules to our advantage? And maybe that's it. We shift the losing earlier in the season. We do it in a way that, like, we try to, thread that needle between seven and 12, or, you know, not being in that, falling in that final three spots. And it's just like, the fact that attached to this proposal, as reported out by Shams Charani at ESPN and Sam Amick at The Athletic, it was like the league will have expanded disciplinary authority to regulate tanking and have the option to reduce lottery odds and or modify draft positions for teams under this proposal. That feels to me like them saying, hey, if you are thinking like that and how you can find the ways to maneuver through the system, understand we have a sledgehammer waiting to come down on you. And I wonder if some teams are going to be like, let me see it.
Yeah.
You know, like if at a certain point it's like, well, this is the system that we have to operate in. And in a system where free agency, as we've discussed, has like kind of died, the way that it operates in terms of big decision, big difference makers moving around, in which attracting talent or acquiring talent via trade, like especially the high priced talent that can tend to be the high value players that swing franchises' fortunes, much more difficult to do under the apron system. Not that trades don't happen, but they're difficult to make happen and to, you know, maneuver through those you know, pitfalls there. And like the draft being the way to get this talent, like it makes you wonder if franchises are going to say, like, we have to go for the talent where we can find it in whatever way we can, and this might still be it. So all of which makes me wonder if this is just like, as you mentioned on the tease heading into the segment, like the league putting this out there to see what the ripples would come back, what the response is going to be. the NBA league office, you know, very attuned to that conversation, let's say, to put that nicely. And so like to see what the brushback or the blowback would be from these things, the feedback would be of these things. And then like, if this, as you mentioned, written in pencil winds up having a little bit of a different look. Cause the other part of it that I thought was funny, and this is from Sam's story, was, the debate about this offering, which league sources say is a combination of three proposals that were proposed during the last general managers meeting on February 21st. And the combination of three separate proposals made me think of the joke about how a camel is a horse drawn by committee. Like the idea that, you know, you set out with a goal. It's like, yeah, there's like four legs and it's big and you ride on it. I don't know. And it's like, well, it wasn't supposed to look like that. And this is where we wind up with these proposals very often. So you wonder if now that people have had a look at it and pointed out, as you did, some of the unintended consequences, if we wind up with a different looking camel in a few weeks, when they actually come down to vote on this.
Well, let's see. I want to give a shout out to this, draft lottery simulator that I saw on social media, this link here, and you can Google it or look this up. It has a very interesting URL, so I'm not going to read here. But I asked our producers, Dan, to kind of, you know, the Walker Texas Ranger lever that Conan O'Brien used to have.
Yeah.
I want to do that here, where we're going to simulate this year's draft lottery. Again, this is not going to be in effect this year, but just for the audience and for us to kind of experiment what this new odds, the flattened odds, where the team with the highest chances is only going to have 8% odds on winning the number one overall pick. And everyone's kind of in the same band, essentially flattened odds for everybody in this group, what that looks like in reality. So here we go. Let's see one poll here from the draft lottery simulator. Memphis is number one. Wow. So they move up from six. Here it is. Orlando at number two and Golden State at number three. And then we see Indiana falling from 2 to 11. And is that, do I have this right? In this draft lottery simulation, we've got the Sacramento Kings falling to 15.
Oh man. And the Nets Brooklyn at 12.
Brooklyn falls to 12. Dan, this is what we're talking about. Is the Orlando Magic would have the number two pick and the opportunity to move to the conference semifinals. And I think like the Orlando Magic, I wouldn't say people are banging down the doors that like that would be totally unfair to add AJ DeBonsa or Darren Peterson to the Orlando Magic. But Steph Curry gets Cam Boozer. Like out of thin air, they move up from 11 to number three, and Dallas getting a top five pick. Okay. But this is what we're talking about, is that the teams like Sacramento that have been inarguably, the Sacramento Kings have been the biggest disaster season of them all, because it didn't seem like they were trying to lose games. They fall all the way to 15. That's just one simulation here, Dan. Let's do another one. Let's see what the next poll reveals here.
Okay.
On the draft lottery results. Oh, yep. Here we go. So in this one, the New Orleans Pelicans go from seven. So this one feels to me like a fairly normal distribution. Sure. Here with Washington falls from 1 to 3. Utah stays at 4. Charlotte moves from 14 to 5. New Orleans gets the number one overall pick, but that goes to the Milwaukee Bucks. They go from 7 to 1. This one, again, the bottom three teams are going to be in the relegation zone. So you're going to see a team like the Brooklyn Nets, again, fall from number 3 to number 12 in this situation, and Memphis going from 6 to 14. So, Dan, it's like, again, to my number one point of this, the unintended consequences that people are going to say this is rigged, or that the NBA is trying to pull the strings here, where you're going to get these weird circumstances where a team like the Golden State Warriors right now, Steph Curry has a really good chance of getting the number one overall pick if this was in place right now. So you just hear a lot more to explain the randomness would be filled in with a lot of nefarious or insidious allegations and I'm not saying any of that is true. I'm saying just the reputation of the league right now as it undergoes a lot of gambling indictments and arrests with NBA players and coaches. The fans already think that this is rigged a lot of the time, and it's unfounded, but you're going to hear a lot more of that in this draft lottery. And let's see what the next third one is here with another poll. Okay, Memphis number one. Washington number one, Memphis number two, Dallas at three, Golden State moves up to 11, or from 11 to four, Orlando to all the way up to number five. Yep. We're going to see a lot of these really good teams that maybe in the eighth seed or the seventh seed in the NBA playoffs move up and get into that top five or win the whole thing. So look, this is yet to be seen. Of course, in 2027 will be the first one we're going to do. But if you go to this draft lottery simulator, you're going to experience a lot of what we're discussing here, is that that 10 through 14 band or that 10 through 16 band is going to get into that top three a lot more than what you're used to. And we're going to see the competitive, right? Like on one end, you have competitive balance, and that's one of the North Stars of the NBA is competitive balance, that all the worst teams have a good chance at, with good process and good administration and good process in the front office and all of the areas of the game that you need to be successful in order to give yourself a best chance of winning long-term, that you have a good shot at this. But this anti-tanking measure, I can see how people would say, this is a step too far. And I would not be surprised if we see some tweaks in the final outcome that we get rid of the 7-8 thing. Like, I think that's number one on my list, is get rid of the opportunity to get the number one overall pick if you lose the 7-8 game. Because I think you're going to see a lot of teams try to fall into that 7-8 game as opposed to being in that top six. Because if you can have the Orlando Magic or the Phoenix Suns this year get the number one overall pick, I think that's just too much of an incentive to not have these front offices sit us. Like, if you have a 50-50 chance or a player's gimpy going into that 7-8 game, I would imagine you're going to hear a lot of, hey, we're going to hold you out of the 7-8 game because you're not all the way there yet, and we want to preserve you for the postseason. We want to preserve you for the playoffs if we get that 8 seed. We don't want to rush you back from this injury to play in that 7-8 game, which is kind of like a shadowy tank. It's not going to be egregious. Another thing here, Dan. Didn't the league already have the ability to, like, penalize these teams? You know, we're seeing that what you called out is that the NBA would have the ability to penalize and take away ping pong balls or lower your odds. I feel like the commissioner already had that latitude with conduct detrimental to the league and fining teams or penalizing teams. I feel like Adam Silver could have had that in his power before, and he only fined two teams this season for their tanking strategies. So whether they would actually be implemented, I think, is another conversation worth bringing up. Like you pointed out, a lot of teams might just say, all right, prove it that you would actually hit us with these fines. Easier said than done.
Yeah. You know, we're going to make you hit the three. We're going to prove, we're going to leave you open out there. You know, show us you're going to take it. Show us you're going to make it. And then while you're doing that, we'll be profiting over here, protecting the paint and maybe getting into the top three of the lottery. You know, who knows? Will have to remain to be seen. But yeah, as you mentioned, the actual determination on these things, not for several weeks. I think KOC had written in his story about this, where he's on board for it. So just, you know, worth checking out at yahoosports.com, mm-hmm. his reasoning why. But, you know, a lot can change in terms of league politics in 5 weeks. And so the finished product might wind up looking a heck of a lot different. And I am too stupid to figure it out now. And so I will look to figure it out later when it all comes down, I don't know, in the conference finals, and drawing our attention away at that point. So exciting times all the way around.
Well, I would say I like the anti-tanking measures in this. I just think it goes too far. And I think it's going to, when you're introducing playoff teams have an incentive to tank out of a play-in game or a playoff game, I think that's, and I've said this to KOC on his show, is like, we should not have playoff games that we're wondering if the team is trying to win, because there's 3% odds of them getting a number one overall pick, or, you know, 15% odds of getting a top five pick if they lose that game. So I think it's a mistake to have playoff teams have an ability to get the number one overall pick. And in the end, my grand theory, pie in the sky theory that everyone has shot down, is just get rid of the draft altogether and give teams basically rookie free agency. And that way you don't have to have this unintended consequences of this is rigged, that Adam Silver is rigging the draft, and you're not going to have tanking. Those two things you would remove from the equation. Tanking allegations and rigged allegations would be removed from the entire conversation in the NBA if you go to a rookie free agency. But
well, good alas. News, Tom. There's a provision in this proposal that can sunset this whole thing in 3 years, and we can have the whole conversation over again in 3 years. So maybe in 2030, there will be an appetite for that kind of destruction. But, you know, TBD, we'll have to keep an eye on it.
Yeah. That's how you know that they're not totally sure about this new reform. And I feel like they're like, hey, this is going to swing the pendulum all the way to the other end. We're playing whack-a-mole with this thing, that they might just scrap the whole thing in 2030. I think they're opening that up. And I think the CBA expires in 2030 as well. So kind of like, let's try this, see how it goes. And then we'll just potentially blow this whole thing up. So I think that's where we're headed. Dan, thanks so much for giving us your insights from Madison Square Garden and helping me out on the Mike Tyson punch out references. I knew you were the right guy for the job. So thank
you
for that.
The main thing I'm good
for. And also, yeah, thank you to Brad, Sarah, Emmy, and the entire Yahoo Sports team, the producers behind the scenes, for making the show a reality. Go subscribe at Yahoo NBA on YouTube. Our show you can watch on YouTube at the all-in-one, one-stop shop at Yahoo NBA. You can get the Dunker Spot and the Kevin O'Connor Show and the Big Number all in one spot on YouTube. If you listen to us on audio, give us a 5-star review, leave us a comment, and we really appreciate it. And Dan, we'll do this again next week.